Mr. Mervyn, reel 22.
Could you see much of fighting elsewhere from Yongdong?
Yeah, the Yongdong
was supposedly a reserve position for the hook. And you could, if the hook was getting the hammer, you didn't have a grandstand view, but you could see the traces going over. You could hear the shells and the guns going off. And you knew the difference between a Bren gun and a Sten gun and a Russian burp gun, You could tell, you can tell by the sound that they make when they fire what who's who and what's what. And it's a bit, I mean, you're sitting, thank God, it's them and not us. It's a case of, I'm all right, Jack. You know, it's great to watch. But you can feel for the lads who were there because they didn't have much chance on the hook. They were that close to the Chinese and they used to come, they did come over in, well, not the thousands, but the hundreds. And all our lads used to do, I mean, it didn't matter who was on the Black Watch, the Dukes or the Australians, they just used to go down into the bunkers and bring their own artillery down in their own positions and to catch the Chinese out in the open. And then usually, well, obviously it happened, by the end of the night, they managed to, the Chinese either packed in or there was a counter-attack went back in and took over the position, and they used to find some of the lads in the bunkers dead, or, you know, where the soldiers got in and tried to save themselves. A bit like that, that film, was it Bunker Hill or something? Something similar to that, but on a different scale.
And you could see this quite clearly.
From we could see, we could see the way the line was, and, you know, they always say you should take the high ground. I think it's a poor policy, like, because if you can get surrounded on the bottom, you're stuck on the top of a hill, like, there's no way of getting off. It doesn't seem very bright to me, but we're always on the high ground, and therefore you can look across the valleys, and you can see what's happening. When the American planes used to come over and drop the napalm bombs, you could grandstand view, watching them come, you know, hoping they were getting on the right ones, like. And I wasn't there, but the other lads who were in D Company, the wrong one position, and they watched the South Korean army put an attack in, saw them coming out the trenches and going across, and they're just sitting back watching it. It was that type of war. It was you worked permanent night shift, and you went to bed during the day, and you were out at night. There was the odd few, obviously, in the trench during the day, but majority of people were kibbling. You maybe get to know, I suppose, oh, they're going to be attacking, so everybody would get up and watch the attack going in. It was that type of war. Funny.
How far away was the hook from Yongdong, from the positions on Yongdong?
Well, I wouldn't like to say. I was never on the hook, you know. I mean, when you look across the valley and that, you know, it was on the same side. I mean, sometimes we didn't even know which way the line went, whether it curved back on it. Obviously, the hook went out like a hook. That was why it was called a hook, you know. And distances. I know when we're on Yongdong, it was a reserve position. It was supposed to be a rest, but you weren't expected any bother on it. You still had to have guards and boat on patrol, and you still had to repair the trenches and make them habitable and all the rest and that. But there was a big, what looked like miles and miles away, and they said, oh, the Chinese are over there, there's no danger of them. We can see them coming and get them with the Air Force, and there was an odd patrol would get across. There were some lads wounded on Yongdong. I think they're up at D Company. A Major Greenwell and two others who were going about on a recce, and they just got out of our lines into the minefield, and the Chinese must have come out the night before, laying up all day, and got them as they were going out.
An ambush.
With just a little ambush, sort of, because than they were away. But the feeling was like that they were that far away, there would be no major or minor attack put in. There would be no, not like we had on 355, because there was such a distance, and our artillery and the mortars and the air force could come in and catch them in the open. And so it was regarded as a cushy number, shall we say. Okay, patrols went out at night just in case. Well, it was a pushing number, except when the tanks come up and start firing the shells and you had to get out the way. But it was pushing even. There wasn't a great deal happening, you know. As I say, we used to look at searchlight every night, sticking up in the air, see if the peace talks were on. And because Syngman Rhee, he was the president of South Korea, he I think at the bottom of him, he didn't want the ceasefire. He wanted the United Nations to go. He wanted to be president of Korea. He wanted it to go on. And there was one Soviet that there was many thousands of prisoners behind.
Were you aware of these things at the time?
We were aware when he let the prisoners loose. You know, he said, he's left them to sod, you know, because there's all these Chinese prisoners running around all over the place. I mean, behind us, he left them out of a prison camp somewhere. We got them out. Had to be rounded up. And
where were you when that happened?
We were up on the front, aye. And then you were always, when you were moving around, you always had to be careful in case of guerrillas. You know, you never heard much of the guerrillas or anything like that. But, I mean, obviously, the war was up and down the country, and there would be pockets of diehards left around, and they would have a shot here and a shot there, you know.
Have you ever experienced anything like that?
No, not with any guerrillas or anything like that. Anywhere. I think when we used to come out the line, you know, you'd get a few hundred yards from the line and your rifles went into the armory, into the company armory, you know, your rifles weren't stacked away. I mean, the Americans, they had the rifles that had them in Japan. Unless you were going out on a specific escort, you didn't have your rifle. Or, like, you know, you had to stay in the camp, right, you know. But, Oh, I don't know, maybe 3 weeks, maybe a month, I don't know, I remember now. But we came off Yongdong. I don't even know who took over from us, it might have been the Australians, but I couldn't say. We came off there, and we went into reserve, and word came around that the peace treaty had been signed, something to the effect that it had been signed, but it wouldn't come into effect until 24 hours. I don't know why. They sign it one day and it doesn't come into effect until the next day. Whether it's to let everybody know that at a certain time the war's finished or what, we don't know. But we were in reserve and we got word, oh, it's finished, and we're all pissed. The Chinese put an attack in against the Americans, and there was a danger of them breaking through, and we had to go and help them, and we were all tight. Running around, we're all John Wayne's going home, running around with the rifles and that, going to help the Americans. And there was a reserve line, I think they called it the Kansas line, and we were supposed to go up there somewhere just behind where the Americans were, and there was wagon loads of dead Americans coming down, and we were going up, you know, couldn't get two hoops, like, whoa. And there was one lad, I forget his name, he got off the wagon and he stepped into a minefield, and I think he got a foot blown off, and that was 12 hours before it finished.
So you've been pulled off Yongdong?
I were in reserve, aren't I?
Was that a reserve camp?
Well, it was a camp where people who were coming out, they went, I mean, maybe the Australians might have been in before us, or the Black Watch, or the Princess Pats, or whoever. And of course, when they leave it, we take over. if it had still been going on, when we went somewhere, the camp would be out and somebody else would take it over. So there was like dugouts in the sense of temporary huts and that, you know. There would be a dugout with a couple of ponchos over the top. And you say, well, you know, you're right in there, or there'd be tents, and there would be a place where a cookhouse would go. While it was like not a permanent camp where you had huts and guard rooms and all the rest, but like a bivouac area where everybody used it who was going in, you know, on this position.
Was it similar to where other camps you've been when you've been out?
Like it was like a rest area, you know.
How far behind the front line would that be?
Oh, not very far. It's hard to tell when you're pulled out at night and you go in at night and the wagons are twisting around and all over the place. I would say, I don't know, a quarter of a mile or something like that. You know, not, you could still, no, well, you had to be close enough to get back up in a hurry in case anything happened. You know, you weren't way back.
So the whole battalion was moved out to this time?
Aye, the whole battalion. But it was like spread out. We weren't all in one camp. We weren't all in one place. We were together, but we were separate, if you know what I mean. Like there was a company on that chair and a company on that chair. You know, you could walk between them, but you weren't neighbours. And they were over a biggish area.
But it would be out of shelling range?
Oh, yes. It was out of... There was no danger of being shelled or shot at, you know, unless there was a sniper or anywhere, something like that.
Can you remember when that was, when you came out in the reserve?
Oh, well, the war finished in July, wasn't it? So we must have only been out 2 or 3 days. I don't know, July, just middle of July. Times and dates are a bit weird now. after, when it finished and it was all sorted out, we were pulled further back. Because what happened then was, one of the clauses of the ceasefire was that existing positions would be destroyed. Like our trenches would be filled in, their trenches would be filled in. And you have this demilitarized zone where nobody's supposed to be in. Actually, they reckon it's the best nature reserve in the world now. it's really good. The naturalists are all for it. But you have the idea was you destroyed your battlements, whatever you want to call them. And so what happened was, while the war was on, all the infantry battalions were in the line and behind the line. Well, the infantry battalions came back, and the engineers and the pioneer corps, they all went in because they had the job of pulling it to bits and wrecking it and everything. So the roles changed, like, and we used to go up and we had to go up and help them. But
just before, come on, under that, you pulled out reserve. You must have realised at that point, or did you realise at that point, that the end was near?
Wait, it was... We thought the end was near the whole time you were there. Because these so-called peace talks went on for months and months and months. And everything would be going all right, then all of a sudden the Chinese would just walk out.
So lots of rumours.
So there was always lots of rumours, and they'd say, why, you know, this is it this time, you know. And then... I think I said before, what would happen was the Chinese, if they put a little attack in somewhere and they thought, oh, we can maybe get some ground here, they would call off the talks to see if they could gain some ground. Then after they'd got some ground and consolidated, they'd start and talk again because they'd got a little bit of land, sort of, you know. And every time, I think maybe that probe that we had on 355 was to see if they could get anything. And if they'd held it, they would have said, they would have broken the talks off. And then when they found they couldn't get any more, they would have started the talks up again. They're always starting up and breaking away and starting up and breaking away. And even to this day, I think they're still the same. They're still talking. There's no peace treaty. There's just a ceasefire. There's still st- still talking, and talks would break up, you know, and this, that, and the other.
So when you came out into reserve, it was no different
to any other one? No different to any other one, no. Just then word came round that...
I was going to ask you how you actually came to hear that...
Well, it would come through the signals. It would come from Panmunjom, was the place where the talks were going and where it was going to be signed. And when the United Nations came out, they would notify, well, they have to notify, I suppose that's why they say 24 hours, notify every unit on that front, and the Air Force and the Navy and everybody, that at such and such a time, there'll be no more shell, you know, say a shell for a shell, a bullet for a bullet, sort of, you know. And so everybody would get to know that, okay, we don't fire back unless they fire at us.
Can you remember getting to know?
Why, just somebody come out and says, hey, it's over, you know. Oh, great, you know, and where's the beer at? Like, let's go and celebrate. And I don't know if it was morning, noon or night when we got to know, but I know we were all celebrating at night and thinking, oh, no more of this, no more of that. And then all of a sudden to come in and get your all going up the line. What the hell for? And we weren't even going on part of our own bit of land, shall we say. It was to prop the Americans up.
Whereabouts was this, you know?
Well, it was obviously somewhere near where we were. As I say, it was dark. We were all...
So it was just a case of, I mean, you were all having a drink.
Aye, aye.
Celebrate.
Aye.
And
then somebody comes up,
trucks,
come down, get your gear, get the rifles, stand guns, brain guns, and away you go.
It's
bloody sure it was. Few of the lads were big gung-ho.
And did you actually get up to the front then?
No. We went into a reserve position. The Americans were getting hammered, and there was a danger that they mightn't hold the line. And so I think their reserves went in, and we went in case they didn't hold it, like, you know.
So this was another position we had?
Aye. I think it was the Kansas line.
Was that just another trench position?
It was another trench position. It was like, you know, the British Army always falls back onto well-prepared defences. They never retreat. They always fall back onto a defensive line. Because sometimes when we were out on rest, you know, out of the line, we were digging this bloody Kansas line. We were going up and digging it and, well, not fortifying it, but, you know, putting the sandbags and getting everything. We were improving. I certainly call the Kansas line.
And this chap who got wounded, was he in your company?
No, he wasn't in our company.
Can you remember what company he was in?
No. I'm not sure. I can't remember his name. I know it was college or something.
Savage.
No.
Was it just something you heard?
Well, we heard, you know, he said, oh, you heard about so and so Savage, he's stepping on my field. And apparently, you find out afterwards, Colonel Barini said that the lad stepped into the minefield, that he must have been a few yards into the minefield. And he was lying there, and of course, nobody wanted to go in the minefield. And Colonel Reed says this young engineer officer came up and he just got a bayonet off somebody, and he went in with a white tape behind him, got to him and pulled him out. And he says, I would have put his name up for a bloody MN. And he says, I would have thought twice about going in. It's at the end of the war and going into a minefield. But I don't know whether the lad lost his foot or his leg or what.
So when you moved into this reserve position behind the Americans, was the fighting going on? Could you hear?
I could hear the bangs and the things going off, you know. And,
was it intensive?
Well, I not say we were out of our eyeballs, but we're, come on, let them come in. You know, we're sure. you know, falls of bravado. If they'd come, well, it might have been a different picture, but I mean, you know, it was, as you say, it was a, we're all not in the back, and then you've got to leave it, and you've got to get your gear, and where you're going, you've got to pile it, where we're going, you're going up the front. But it's finishing tomorrow. And then there's a wagon loads of dead Yanks come past. And
Aye,
and then the same way we're going to strengthen the Americans in case we're getting the hammer. One, you know, them, one of their cars was getting the hammer. But, aye, it was a bit hairy.
So when was the ceasefire due to take effect? Can you remember?
No. Not being in the line. We weren't there to, shall we say, stick our head up. I think you would have been a brave man, see, it was to come at 12 o'clock lunchtime, a brave man to stick his head up a minute after 12 o'clock, like, and see if it was really in effect. But apparently they did, you know, obviously they got up and walked along the top, and I think they could see the Chinese as well. I mean, when all said and done, that's them poor little buggers as well, they wouldn't, same as us. They would be glad that it was over. You just do as you're told, and that's it. So,
so how long did you man this reserve position?
Oh, we were back out the next morning. Sobered up and brought us back out.
Where did you go from there?
Back to where we were. Back to this camp, this rest place, and then after the 24 hours, whatever time it was. We moved further back to another white. I suppose it was a more of a permanent camp. There was sort of tents up. The headquarters company had tents and everything. Well, we had tents as well. But we weren't as a battalion like at Bransworth Camp or at Strensel Camp. We weren't all round a parade square. We were spread out. And we were near enough that each company had to supply in its turn. Soon get back to bullshit, you know. I mean, the bloody piece had only been signed, and then you've got to start and do these stick guards and all the rest, and you know, get all the gear pulled up and everything. And it would be, see, I know once it was D Company's turn to mount the guard for the headquarter company, you know, where you're standing there. To attention, then you know, you call up the guard and this, that, and the other. All that, well, it was straight there. As soon as it finished, it was straight there. And for some reason, somebody said we had to put white on our weapon. You know, your rifle sling, where it's normally khaki. They said, do it white. So we did it with foot powder, you see. And our weapon belts. We did them right. And we got there. And then, there was a Larry Burney that did the nut. There's only supposed to be military police wear white. So we had to go back and scrub it off. We had an hour to get put square again and march back again. And then you had to, that was my first time as Lance Corporal for the guard, you know, there's a full corporal on and me. I don't know, four or five lads. And the old guard standing with the tent and the barrier. The old guard standing over there and we standing on this side. And then you know I had to march our guard, the one who was gonna be the guard. March him across the road, right, wasn't a road, a bit of earth and ground, you know. March him across to the where the guard was, and then he had to about turn, and then you sort of, old guard and new guard, take post, you know, all that running. And the lad who I was talking over, he about turned the wrong way. Instead of right, he went left. Got another bollocking for that. Oh, God, you know, first time. I thought, this is bloody awful, this. And but that's straight away.
The you hadn't done anything like
we hadn't
that
done it. No, before, no, never done that, you know. And straight away, the bullshit's there, and the guards are there, and you know the dust hadn't settled.
As soon as you come out,
when the piece had been signed, bang, that was it. Kit inspections. I mean, we kept ourselves clean and the gear as well as could be expected under the conditions, and we were clean, you know. But my God, as soon as I picked, you just think the RSM and not, right, we're going to play soldiers again now. We've just been playing cowboys, you know. We're going to play soldiers now. And we're drilling on the square. Well, not the square, but a level ground. And it just bang like that. And I thought, I don't like this. I didn't like the other. I didn't like the ceremonial side of it. No good.
This was an attempted camp, slightly more permanent than the last one.
Yeah.
Was the whole battalion here?
Yeah, as I say, they were within. It's hard to explain it because it's such a bloody hilly country. And they would sort of position the headquarters in one place, and then, if you can imagine, the cowboy pictures where they have like box canyons. Well, there was lots of sort of stuff like that. You would have a company up this canyon and a company up here and a company up there. You may be separated by a little hill, but you were all within 10 minutes, quarter of an hour of getting down to the headquarters company. But if you were on the extremity, it would take you a while to get to the company on the other extremity. You know, it was a bit like, well, it was very hilly, you know. Just the same, just makeshift. It was homemade beds and all the rest, you know. But we've got a bit of a laugh at times because one of the agreements of the ceasefire was that neither country, the United Nations or the North Korea, whoever they were, would increase the armies by any more men than the time when it was signed. So naturally they were bringing as many men in as they could in that last 24 hours. So we had 10,000 men, you know. And some of these lads coming in, they were RASC, Royal Army Service Corps lads, the lads that drive the wagons and all the rest. And we used to have to go, I said we had to go up and help the engineers pull the lines to bits. Well, I mean, we were looking to see what we could find. Looking to see if we could find any burp guns or any stuff that lads had left in the, you know, out. So it was scavenging, if you want to put it, just to see what was what. Anyway, we got some lads in the battalion who hadn't finished the training in Japan, but had been shipped over to bring the numbers up. And some RAC, you see, and for the take goes up to the front line, the RAC drivers would land up with the big three-ton wagons, and we would all pile in, and then they would take us up to wherever we had to go to help the engineers and that, or a signal is pulled, signal wire out, or out like that, up. And there was one place where we came, you've got to remember all the roads there, they're not tarmac, the country roads there, like dolomite roads there, hard packed earth and that. So you just come along the side of this hill, and it was like a U-turn, and you went down. Well, the wagons, they couldn't get the lock on to get round, so they had to go forward, then reverse back, and then they could go down. Well, it was a kind of drop, you know. And this young lad, he went forward, and he stopped all right, but when he put in reverse, he couldn't, the wheels were just spinning, and he couldn't get it back, like. So one of the other experienced drivers had to get in and take, we're all in the back, like, you know, and got him back. And then he got him turned around and faced to come down this bank. Great. So the young gets back in again, and the wagons, when they were going down the bank, they got to the bottom and they waited until everybody got down. Why, this sort of went down like the clappers, and of course, he couldn't stop because it was just skidding, it was just like ice. He put his brakes on and things still going, and they just then, oh, God, so I started jumping off before I got to the bottom. You started visions of piling in the other wagons at the bottom. And as he was slowing down with a bugger this, we were jumping out like, you know,